I would say this to any HMA consultant in the marketing field. You have the information. You have far more information than your clients have, and you can help these people, and they desperately need your help. It's hard to get started, but it does work, and it can work really well for you, and it can be a great service for your clients.
Hi, it's Michael Senoff with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. The title of this interview is called How to Control the Sales Call and Other Hidden Marketing Asset Tips from a Veteran Marketing Consultant. Barry Marr got his first sales job as a kid selling magazine subscriptions door-to-door. It was a hard gig to have because the subscriptions were hundreds of dollars, and this was back in the 1960s. Barry learned right away that saying something like, "I'm selling magazines, would you like to buy some?" was the quickest way to get the door closed in your face. People always said no. Barry says it's the same thing when it comes to selling consulting services. You can't just go around asking people if they need your help. They'll always say no. You've got to engage prospects in a conversation that naturally guide them to a close. And you can do that by controlling the sales call. So in this audio interview with Barry, you'll hear how to hit all the sales points you want to hit in the order you want to hit them without getting the door closed in your face, even when a prospect tries to derail you. You'll also learn why it's easier to sell consulting services at a higher fee than it is to cut price and attract cheapskates. You'll also learn the fastest known way to use speaking engagements to land clients while also using them as a high-end product in and of themselves. You'll learn the pricing structure Barry uses in his practice today and exactly what he says when someone tells him his consulting fees are too high. Believe it or not, he always agrees with them. You'll hear Barry's five-step process for setting up a successful consulting practice, from how to be your own worst prospect to making your skeletons dance for you. This advice could take you from the ground up. You'll hear why Barry says it's important to brag about the negatives or weak parts of your practice and how to do that the right way so it actually works to your advantage. You also hear the word-for-word sales pitch Barry used when he was a kid that worked to sell those expensive magazine subscriptions and how he adapted that same sales pitch and those same sales strategies to land clients today. Barry says controlling the sales call has never involved talking over the customer or ignoring their objections. It involves acknowledging what they're saying while keeping the conversation on track. And in this audio interview, you'll hear how Barry does that and a lot more from this expert consultant who's been consulting sales calls for a long time. Now let's get going.
Can I help you?
Hey, Barry. Mike Senoff here.
Hi, Mike.
How did you first get started in business?
Actually, I first started out in business. I had my own advertising specialist company. It was just like a one-man shop. And basically what I did was I went around selling advertising specialties to anybody I could talk into buying them.
Were you entrepreneurial in nature?
It was my own business. We built up a business for myself and my partner. We ended up covering the entire state of California. Then we spread out to other states. Then I made the mistake of selling the business. And from then, I went into the Yellow Pages and became a Yellow Page consultant and a management consultant and a marketing consultant, so that was my background.
You've got a consulting practice right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
How long have you been consulting for?
Since 1986.
Can we talk about your process of how you generate clients?
Sure.
How do you generate clients for consulting? Are you still out there marketing yourself?
Absolutely. Much of what I do now is in the speaking business, so I do seminars and workshops, which means I'm hired by corporations and associations to come in. And we do everything we can to get my name out there as much as possible. I mean, I've got these books, No Lie, Filling the Glass, Legend, the book on Yellow Page Advertising, the marketing yearbook. I've got those out there. We generate articles from those books, and I've got an assistant that sends these out and gets them placed all in various publications all over the place, gets them placed all over the Internet. We get my name out there as much as possible. We do as many interviews of all types, like this one, as possible. On
mm-hmm.
radio, little TV, it's harder to get. You got to be there. That's part of the problem. Whatever we can do to get my name out there. But we're talking about speaking engagements. My assistant is also making a certain amount of cold calls every single day. When he's got spare time, he's on the phone generating those calls.
You charge for these speaking engagements, right?
Oh, yeah.
What do you charge for these?
Speakers make very good livings. I make more money from the speaking than I make from writing.
How about comparing consulting and speaking?
Well, they're part and parcel of the same thing. Sometimes it's hard to tell if the speaking engagement or a consultation, because it might be the same thing. If I'm going in there and I'm doing an extended sales or marketing training, I might be in the company for a day, 2 days, 3 days, a week, several weeks. It's really hard to say whether that's a consultation or a speech, or I might be in there and do a one-hour keynote and also do a follow-up consultation.
You could charge for the speaking engagements, and those speaking engagements, it's a product in itself, but it's also a lead generator for your consulting practice.
It's a product for itself. Sometimes the consultations are a lead generator for the speaking engagements. They work hand in hand.
So give me an example of how you landed a good consulting contract from a speaking engagement.
Well, I have a client who I've worked with a number of times over the years, and they called me up at one point. They saw an article that I'd written in a publication probably in the late 90s. I'd probably written this article in the late 80s, but people clip these things. They hang on to them, and this guy tracked me down, because in those days it wasn't as easy to find people as it is now with the Internet, and called me up and said, could you come in and do a seminar on advertising for my advertisers? And that seminar led to extended consulting. I've been consulting with him ever since, off and on. I'm on retainer with him right now.
If you have someone interested in your consulting service, say, Barry, you know, I want you as my consultant. Can you take us through how you structure the deal, how you charge for your services, fee versus retainer or contingency? Do you do any contingency as well?
No, I don't do contingency. In fact, I never did do contingency.
Is there a reason why?
I don't need to. I can charge and I can get my fees. And we've never found a need for that. Now, if what I did didn't work, we couldn't do it for very long.
Mm-hmm.
But I have the expertise, being an author, on whatever subject they call me in, they've usually found out that I have this expertise to begin with. They've seen me in USA Today or the New York Times or something like that. Or if we've done the cold call, we've made sure that they found out about the fact that I was in USA Today or New York Times or whatever it is to establish the expertise. So I can usually get my fee. I'm not ashamed of my fees. And I don't mealy-mouth around them. People ask me if I'm expensive. Absolutely. And why do I charge so much? Because I can.
Can I ask you what you charge for a good-sized client?
It depends on the situation. These are all negotiated. I mean, I have set rate for fees, but it depends on the situation. And the first thing I do is I find out what their needs are. I don't go in there with a prepackaged set of programs that I try to foist upon them. I go in there, and again, just like filling the Yellow Page ad, I do a fact-finding. Because they don't know very often what they want. They know there's an issue. Or maybe they didn't even know there was an issue. Maybe Steve called them up. And they said, you know, my marketing isn't what it could be, or my management strategies maybe aren't what they could be. Maybe this guy can tell us something. So we have to tell them how they can buy my services. And the only way we can do that is finding out about them and how we might be able to help them. So they might have called about one thing, or we might have called them about one thing. And I might end up doing something else entirely different. I might end up doing a series of trainings.
I want to bring this up. Picture in front of you, you've got five somewhat new salespeople selling marketing consulting services. And obviously because they're new, their confidence level isn't where yours is at. And I tell people, you know, many times when you're quoting a fee, the way these guys do it is they charge a per-project basis. There's seven projects. They close on the first one, developing a USP for the client before anything, and they charge anywhere between X and X per project.
Mm-hmm.
But the confidence level, what would you say to these guys related to confidence and consistent with what they charge? You know, because many times their confidence may be so low, they may only charge $250 a project or $1,000 a project, where if their confidence was higher, they could charge $3,000 or $4,000. What would you tell them if they were sitting in front of you?
Well, number one, there's a couple of ways. How do you get confidence? Let me ask you that.
Experience.
Bingo. How do you get experience? You
doing it.
Or you study it. Or you learn it. If I'm going out there and I'm selling my service to somebody, it's not fake it till you make it. You've got to do the research. You've got to actually become the expert that you're talking about. Once you become the expert, which is not hard to do, because if you're dealing with small businessmen, most of them don't have a clue about marketing. You don't have to know much to know a whole lot more than they do. You don't have to know much to be able to help them. When I first started out selling advertising specialties, I knew very, very little about advertising. I mean, I had a couple courses here and there. But I knew an infinite amount more than they did, and I helped them in the areas where I knew I could help them. And then as I gained more expertise, I moved into those other areas. Now, one of the things that people have a hard time realizing is that it's easier to sell at a higher fee very often than it is when you start cutting price. You don't want people buying just on your fee. I mean, who do you want? Do you want a marketing consultant that has to charge $250 to do a project, or a marketing consultant that's going to charge you $2,500 to do the sale of the same project? All things being equal, how good can that marketing consultant who's charging $250 be?
So from your experience, even with a higher price, you sometimes get a better result.
Almost always get a better result. Now, you've got to establish value.
Right.
I can't say, hey, I'm brand new in the business. I've never done this before. I'd like to try it out on you. I'm going to charge you top fee.
Did your fees go up as your confidence increased?
Absolutely.
What did you start at?
See, I didn't start this till after I wrote the book. I'd already spent literally years finding out about the subject, plus I've been years in advertising and marketing. So I had a certain expertise. So I started out, I think, at $95 an hour. A lot of the times I didn't get $95 an hour, I'd say, you know, this is going to be $95 an hour, but I would have to put so much work into it that what I might charge him for 1 hour, I might have done 4 hours work. Because if I did something where I didn't have the expertise, I had to gain the expertise.
So your per hour fee, I'm sure, is substantially more than that.
It is substantially more than that now. Many, many times more than that.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if I'm on a weekly basis or something like that, it's still high,
mm-hmm.
but it's not what it would be for a keynote or something like that.
All right, if these five guys, they're in front of you, and they were going out making calls, making sales calls on the small business owner, the guy who's still running his business, who's at the shop, who's working it, from your experience, how would you identify the mindset of that business owner? And you're coming in as a marketing consultant. Could you categorize, like, the mindset of the business owner?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the problem we first came out with when I first became a Yellow Page consultant. When we first sold the Yellow Page book, I had an agent at the time because I'd written other books. He sold this book to the original publisher. We thought we were going to sell millions of copies of this thing because there are 5 million advertisers out there that advertise in the Yellow Pages, and none of them had a clue. And there are all these different competing directories, and for a number of reasons. You know, they're all spending hundreds of dollars a month on Yellow Pages, and the book sold for $19.95. But we could not imagine why anybody who's spending $300 a month and up in the Yellow Pages, and this is, you know, almost 20 years ago, wouldn't spend $19.95 for a book. Right?
Right.
It's a no-brainer, especially since this book, there's been years of research going into this book, and it was the best information on the subject they knew nothing about. Guess what? They didn't know they knew nothing about it, and they didn't care. We had to generate the business just like anything else. These people don't realize they need marketing. They don't realize they need advertising. But if they do, they do it on the smallest level they can possibly imagine. Most of them are not spending nearly enough money on marketing and advertising, but they don't know that. And if you ask them to spend $100, it's like you're taking money out of their back pocket. They really have the mindset that, well, you know, I'm going to put my sign out there, I'm going to spend money on office furniture, I'm going to pay my help, I'm going to buy the best equipment, I'm going to do this stuff. And then when it comes to marketing and advertising, the first thing they cut, or the first thing they don't spend money on when they open the doors. So you've really got to educate them on the value of getting people in there. And the best way to do that is to talk about the customers you're going to bring them, you know, how it's going to change their lives, how it's going to make a difference in their business.
In the first chapter of your book, you talk about making the skeleton dance. What does that mean?
Well, it comes from a quote from George Bernard Shaw that said, if you can't get rid of the family skeleton, you might as well make it dance. Now, we've all got negatives in everything we're presenting against the negative idea. So what can you do? You can hide them. You can basically lie to the customer or hide them. You can mealy-mouth around them and try and slip them by them unnoticed. Or you can bring them out and brag about them. And it's a lot easier to bring them out and brag about them, just like I did a minute ago when I was talking about my fees. Are my fees expensive? Absolutely. And why do I charge so much? Because I can. Because my clients aren't just willing to pay these kind of rates. They're happy to pay them for the kind of results I generate. So I'm taking a negative, which is the huge negative we all think about, is price, oh my God, price, and turning it into a positive. Somebody asks me about my prices, yeah, they're expensive. I'm thinking of raising them. I'm bragging about the negative.
Chapter 2, you are your most important customer. Can you expand on that?
It's exactly what you were talking about a moment ago. Confidence, confidence. If I don't believe in myself, which is what I'm selling, if I don't believe in whatever my products may be, but in this case marketing consulting, and if I can't sell it to myself, how am I going to sell it to somebody else? I might be able to if I'm a really good actor, if I'm a really good salesman, but I'm not going to feel good about it. You've got to believe in it yourself. And how do you believe in it yourself? By becoming everything you claim to be. And that's not easy. That's why you have to do the research and you have to become good at it. And you may have to do a couple of gigs on spec to begin with.
You've got a protocol set up here. Step 1, becoming your most difficult prospect.
Exactly, because you want to ask all the questions that the customer's going to ask or the client's going to ask. You've got to sell yourself thoroughly. Again, it's the same thing. You've got to be completely convinced. So if the client throws you an objection, you're going to have an answer to it. If you have that objection in your own head and you secretly agree with him, you know, well, you're too expensive. You're thinking, yeah, I am. I should only be charging $25 an hour. And he says, you're too expensive. You're going to wilt. In my case, if I'm thinking, he says, you're too expensive. I say, I'm $250 an hour or whatever I might say. I'm going to say, hey, you know, for the results I can generate you, the difference I can make in your business, you got to be kidding me. Somebody was posting one of an RFP for a keynote the other day, and I won't say the name of the company, but it's a nationally known company. And they wanted a motivational speaker, which is one of the things I do, sales motivational speaking, who would come in there and address all their retail sales reps who are calling on retail customers all around the country and help them take their product to $100 million a year, which was their goal. And this was on the RFP. And do you know what they wanted to pay that keynote speaker?
What?
$500. Absolutely ludicrous. That if I didn't have the confidence that I could go in there and talk to those people and make a difference in the way they were presenting what they were presenting and help them meet that $100 million goal, hey, they did have people lined up. When I talked to that woman because I was curious about it, I called her up. And I said, are you getting any response to this thing? And she says, I've got people lined up. Because all of those motivational speakers thought they were worth $500. Now, I don't know if I want a salesperson or a sales trainer or a sales motivational speaker who can't sell their own services for more than $500 trying to motivate my people to get them to a $100 million goal.
Can you tell me two stories? One of the most exciting stories you can think of that first pops into your head about you landing a client or obtaining a client that really excited you. And number two, a nightmare client story.
A client that really excited me.
Just any time in your career that you're like, man, yeah, I got that client. And it just ended up being financially rewarding and fulfilling.
Let me tell you something that plays to the issue of confidence. First started out doing motivational speaking. And what I do is, I'm not quite sure if it's classified motivation. We call it real world tactics, reality based motivation. If we try to base the motivation on the real world rather than let's all think happy thoughts, and things would be wonderful. So when I wrote Filling the Glass, which was dealing with management issues and marketing issues in that way, put together a presentation. Now, I had always done real nuts and bolts presentations at that point, marketing, sales, yellow pages, these kind of things, communication. And this was kind of a leap for me in terms of actually presenting this to people. Now, the first time I did it for a very major corporation, and not only did I do it for a major corporation, I did it for their senior executive. And to say I was nervous was really an understatement. Extremely nervous because, again, these are very sharp, very senior people, and I'm doing something that I'd never really done before. This was going into more strategies, the kind of strategies we're talking about now, the kind of strategies of Filling the Glass, be your own guru, change the scale, make the skeleton dance, and it was also inspirational and motivational. So it was a very different thing from when you say this, this will get you this in a sales call, or design your yellow page ad, put a headline in it, put a good illustration in it, that kind of thing. So I was extremely nervous, particularly dealing with senior level people, because I was going to be telling them about how to manage their own business, and these people were, you know, at 20, 30 years of managing. Now, when that presentation finished, and there was a dead silence, finished the presentation, I thought it had gone really well. But I finished, I said, I'm Barry Maher, thank you very much, and there was dead silence. And, you know, it was one of these deals, my heart dropped into my stomach. And then somebody started clapping, and the entire group stood up and gave me a standing ovation. That was probably the most satisfying moment I've had as a consultant or as a speaker, because it was a confidence level thing. I realized that I had done it, I could do it, and then, of course, when they hired me for more gigs, that was icing on the cake, and I, you know, I established a relationship with these people. And I can remember going in the limousine back to the airport after that with another speaker who had been on before me. And I just can remember the feeling, the total satisfaction that, yeah, you know, I'd set out to do this thing. And at least at that moment, it really worked. And so far it's worked since then, so hopefully it'll keep working.
Okay, great. And how about a nightmare client?
Nightmare client. Same presentation. Quite a bit after that one I did. I went in there and I had a client that wanted me to work with their sales force, and they were a nationally known company. It was a branch of a nationally known company. And they were very weird about hiring me. They looked through my website, they saw all my credentials and everything, and they kept saying, are you going to talk about this? Are you going to talk about that? And I said, I'll talk about whatever you want. I just need to get the information. He said, well, we really need to see you. So we tried to arrange a time they could see me. There wasn't a time they could come and see me. But they hired me anyway. I gave them a particularly good rate because they were part of a national organization. And I figured I could deal with many of theirs. But they were very, very paranoid. I couldn't quite put my finger on it. So they said, well, we want you to do a second training, too. And again, I granted, it was one of these deals where I cut my own price. Not by cutting the price, by giving them a second training. And I probably shouldn't have. But it was in my hometown, and it was an easy thing to do. And again, I wanted to work with these people. So I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll do the first session. I'll do my normal session. And for the second workshop, I will have a discussion with these people, and you give me the agenda. I'll go in there, and I'll talk about sales, and we'll talk about whatever you want to talk about. Well, 2 days from the presentation, I still haven't got the agenda from these people for this second session. So this guy sends me this email, which basically says, just go in there and talk about sales. So again, I do the presentation. It goes over well. Didn't get a standing ovation. We got a nice ovation. People came up to me afterwards. I did the sales presentation. This guy that had hired me was there, and I could see he wasn't liking what I was talking about. People were asking me. They brought in their secretarial staff, which they didn't tell me till later. And people were asking really, really basic questions on sales. I mean, very, very basic. So I'm thinking, who am I talking to here? And I'm dealing with these basic questions. And at one point, the person that had hired me asked me a specific question, and it was absolutely wrong about what he was talking about. It was something like, basically about being forthcoming with a client. And he was trying to get me to say that maybe the best way to deal with a client was to ignore this particular objection that the customer had, which would have killed any possible sale. And as tactfully as I could, I contradicted him in front of his group of people. Well, the session went over, it ended. I wasn't happy with it. I don't think the people in the room were happy with it. And this guy blasted me afterwards. I mean, not there in person. He sent me a letter that went on for probably 5 pages afterwards about how unprofessional I was, how I hadn't been prepared, how the session had been done at an extremely, extremely basic level, and how my information was just flat out incorrect that I was giving them. Well, the problem was that I contradicted him and not tactfully. I had gone into the presentation, and I hadn't made sure that I was properly prepared. I'd allowed them to slide by without setting a proper agenda. I'd allowed them to slide by without letting me know just who was in the room, because apparently there was a lot of support staff, but there were also senior salespeople who were completely bored by the presentation.
So what's the lesson in that? If you were to talk to those 5 consultants sitting in front of you, getting ready to go into a business and help them with their marketing consulting, and they may have to go in front of the salespeople and do a sales presentation to show them how to upsell and increase their sales. Because there's going to be some paranoid people on the other end. Who is this consultant, this independent marketing consultant? What are they going to do? Are they fearful of losing their jobs? You know what I'm saying?
And they should absolutely be. They have a right to be paranoid. They have a right to be concerned. And they should do what I didn't do. What I did, because I was very busy, was I prepared the first presentation, and that went over fine. I allowed them to take responsibility for preparing the second presentation, and when it wasn't coming through like it should have, I didn't follow up and make sure that it was done and done correctly. I didn't find out who was going to be there. I just assumed it was just going to be salespeople. I didn't ask the question. I didn't pin this person down on the material that was going to be covered when they didn't give me the material. Even though they said they were going to take care of it, I was the one standing up in front of the room. I was the one who was presenting a presentation they weren't happy with at the end of the day. And so I should have taken responsibility to make sure that it was done properly, even though he said he was going to do it.
I want to get back to your protocol. Step 5, more expensive, less reliable, and proud of it.
Absolutely. Again, bragging about the negative. You got a product out there. Not everybody can have the best product in the marketplace, right?
Right.
Maybe your product is more expensive. Maybe it's less reliable. But I can brag about that negative. I can brag about virtually any negative. If the customer is right or the prospect is right about their objection, granted. Are machines more expensive? Absolutely. Are they less reliable? Absolutely. But look, we're the leaders in the marketplace. Why do you think that happens in spite of the fact that we're more expensive, in spite of the fact that we're less reliable? Because blah, 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 blah. And then you give all the reasons.
Back it up with reasons why.
Back it up with the reasons why. You know, the greatest thing about a negative is it builds such incredible credibility. Yes, our machines are less reliable than the competition. I won't give you the name of the company, but I'm dealing with a company that sells very sophisticated technical equipment. And they had a situation where virtually every piece of their technical equipment that they sold to a government agency didn't work. Can they brag about that? Absolutely, they didn't work. Every single one of them failed. But yet, what did we do about that? We got on the situation immediately. We found out the problem. We fixed it so it'll never happen again. So the problem is not that the product has problems. Every product has problems. Every program has problems. What did we do about it? How did we handle it? What did we learn from it? Now, that's why we're the leader in the industry. We're the leader in the industry, not just in spite of that problem, but because of those kind of problems and how we deal with them.
Let's skip ahead. That's well stated. When the truth kills the sale, what's that mean?
Once in a while, the truth kills the sale. This is about selling the idea to yourself, too. If I can't tell the truth and still make the sale, then I've got to find a way to change that truth. Yeah, Michael, you know, I really don't know much about marketing. Yeah, Michael, I'm really expensive. Would you like to hire me? You know, if I can't find a way to tell the truth and still make the sale, I have to change the truth. I have to become more of an expert. I have to change my prices. So I really believe that it's a great deal I'm giving the customer. It doesn't have to be the best possible deal. It just has to be a deal that I can believe in. So when the truth kills the sale, you got to change that truth. And there are a lot of ways of doing that. And I wouldn't suggest changing prices. That's one of the last things I'd do. Because then you're just selling price. Somebody can always beat you on price. I'd suggest changing the value. Throwing in a little bit more, giving a little extra, becoming more of an expert. So you can tell the truth, you can brag about whatever the negatives might be, and still close the sale.
Here's another section. Tell, sell the whole story. What's that saying? The more you tell, the more you sell?
Interesting. That's an old sales and marketing thing, and there's a certain amount of truth to that. When I was a kid, I was one of these kids that sold everything. From the time I was five, I sold greeting cards door to door, you know, to win a bike or whatever it is you supposedly earned at those.
Were you number one then?
Yeah. Well, it was annoying. You know, you go to the neighbor's house and you bang on the
door. I did it too.
Yeah, and so you know the drill. Now, when I was 16, the first real job I had was selling magazine subscriptions. You know, they take a bunch of us kids and they ship us over to some distant neighborhood and they set us loose on the poor souls that live there. And the first line of the pitch was, "Hi, I'm Barry, one of the boys in the neighborhood." You know, I was Barry and I was a boy and I was in the neighborhood, but I didn't live there. Not the way to sell. I shouldn't have known better. Anyway, in the neighborhoods where we'd work, we'd sometimes encounter people we didn't want to waste our valuable 16-year-old time pitching because they'd be drunk or they'd be underage or they'd be crazy or maybe it was pretty clear they'd never passed the credit check because our magazine packages were like $360 and this was back in the mid-60s, so they're really expensive. So in order to get rid of one of these people as quickly as possible, we simply had to ask them one question, which was, would you like to buy some magazines? Exactly what we're selling. Nobody ever said yes. Right? Nobody even said maybe. Nobody even asked us what magazines we were selling. They just said no and walked away. And a lot of people, when they're selling their services, in effect, ask their customers, would they like to buy some magazines? Would you like some marketing consulting? I'm doing marketing consulting now. You know, I think I can really help you out. Are you interested? No. Of course you're not interested. You've got to tell them, you've got to sell them the whole story. Now, the problem is, that means to one extent or another, you've got to do some kind of a presentation after you do your fact-finding, after you've established interest, you do your fact-finding. You've got to do some kind of a presentation. And people say, well, I don't want to do a presentation. Well, what's a presentation? A presentation is just all the information you want these people to have before they make that decision whether or not to do business with you. If you can't give them that information, you're not going to give them the right decision. So you need to have to make this presentation, and it shouldn't be a, okay, now I'm going to orate for 15 minutes like I'm doing right here. It should be a conversation.
Now, I'm sure you know it. Give me the pitch when you knocked on the door to sell that package of magazines.
You started out, "Hi, I'm Barry, one of the boys in the neighborhood. We're taking a survey to see which was the most popular magazines." And I give them a card, and they check on the card which magazines they like. And then I go into my pitch about how I was developing a route in the neighborhood. Well, the magazines were mailed to them. Nobody was ever developing a route. It really wasn't the way to sell.
That's a great story. I can totally relate to that. I have cut lawns and knocked on doors. I knocked on a lot of doors myself.
Yeah, I did that too. What I used to do, I'd sell the jobs to other kids.
There you go.
I didn't like mowing the lawn, but I like getting the job.
That's great. I'm going to move on a little bit here. Becoming an expert witness.
Goes on the same lines as what we were talking about before. Now, expert witnessing, if any of your people have ever done any expert witnessing, it's a really great thing. You get to sit up in this little front throne, right, in front of the entire room of people, and they hang on your every word, and they even transcribe it for posterity. The problem is that after the attorney on your side tosses you all the softball questions he's going to toss you, then the attorney on the other side gets his chance, which is the cross-examination. And during the cross-examination, this guy tries to get you to contradict everything you've said before. Now, the tendency as an expert is to contest every one of the points he's trying to get you to make, right? I mean, after all, you're the expert. You've staked out your position. You've delivered the word of God, and this guy's attacking it. So by extension, he's attacking you, maybe even attacking God, right?
Right.
But the first thing the attorneys on your side will tell you is that if you contest every one of the points he's trying to get you to make, you're going to lose all credibility as an impartial expert. Now, are you impartial? Everybody in the courtroom knows you're being paid big bucks by the side you're on. But the more you appear to be an instrument of objective credibility, of an impartial expert, the more effective the points that you need to make will be. So when people are selling, when people are promoting themselves, they always want to present themselves as an expert witness. They make their best possible case. I used to say, hey, I don't want you to forget, I'm on commission here. The more you spend, the more I make. Now let me tell you why you need to be spending more and making me more money. So I make my best possible case, and I don't pretend not to be an advocate if I'm an advocate. I don't have to. And then I grant the opposition, which is not the person I'm trying to sell. That's never the opposition. But the opposition is the doubting Thomas in the mind of that person. I grant that doubting Thomas his legitimate points. When he's right, he's right. If I can say to the customer, you're absolutely right about that. All our cameras failed on that. And what did we do about it? Absolutely right. My rates are expensive. If I can say that, I've granted him his legitimate points, something he knows is right anyway, and all the rest of my points gain massive credibility, rather than the pretending that I'm offering him the only perfect service that's existed since the beginning of time.
All comes down to credibility and believability.
All comes down to credibility and believability. The best way to be credible is to tell the truth.
Now tell me, how did you get this philosophy? Is this something just evolved through your experience?
Absolutely. You know, at first you're afraid. Now, I've done so many sales calls, so much marketing in my life, that at first you're afraid to bring out these points. And then as you get more and more confident, you realize, hey, I can say these things. It not only doesn't hurt, it helps. And if it hurts, isn't it much better to get out this problem now? If a person's got a problem with whatever issue you're trying to hide, isn't it better to get it on the table now than to leave them to discover it later when you're not around and you're going to have no influence over the situation? So it's much easier to deal with these things now, even if it does create a problem. And if you do it right, it doesn't create a problem. It increases your credibility.
Great. Sex, rejection, and several assorted butts. What's this about?
That's a catch-all chapter. Sex. One of the things I say when I see people losing attention in my keynote, which of course they never do, towards the end of the keynote, one of the things I say is the next section can be either about sex or it can be about dating. And everybody's eyes light up. Sometimes I say dating because in some parts of the country they might not want me to say sex. So when I say dating, only one eye lights up, but it gets their attention. So what I tell people is when I'm out there is your business, whether it's marketing, consulting, or any other business, is kind of like sex. If you're not enjoying it, you're probably not doing it right. You know, Warren Buffett said he worried about people who were doing something in their life that they didn't enjoy, that hoped that in the future they'd be able to do something that they really liked. He said, that's putting off sex to your old age. Not a good idea. That's the idea of enjoyment. Now, the sorry butt thing, I just wrote an article about this for my newsletter, and I think it's in my book, No Lie, too. Sorry butt, a situation where I had with a customer one time. And I walked in there, and I was pitching him whatever I was pitching him. I gave him all the reasons why he should buy the service, and it was right. He should have bought the thing. And I gave him all the reasons why it was an excellent value, and I was right about that. And I gave him all the reasons why he should buy it now, and I was right about that. But he said, you know, I really got to think about it. I'm really not ready to make a decision right now. And I said, well, you know, I haven't given you the best reason at this point. And he said, well, what's the best reason? I said, because getting it right now is the quickest way to get my sorry butt out of your office. And he said, sold.
That's great.
So when I started telling people that story around the office, it became known as Barry Maher's sorry butt clothes.
That's like Zig Ziglar's. You know, when I first started in sales, I studied all his clothes. And Zig Ziglar's, when they said, well, when I get around to it, I'll do it. And he had a round, you know, the round to, well, here's a round to it, and now you got it, let's do it.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Humor is a great way to make your point, and it's a great marketing tool. It can be a great sales tool if you use it effectively. It can also be a disaster if you use it ineffectively.
Let's go to closing made simple. Give it a shot.
And that is simply trying to get through all the miasma of possible closes that the sales trainers sometimes teach. And I teach them too when I'm doing sales training. There are thousands and thousands of different closes. People always say, which one's the best? None of them the best. Which one works at this particular time is the best one. And there are thousands of them. And I tend to go with the assumed close, where you just go ahead and you go through until somebody stops you. And if they don't stop you, you close on them. And that's fine. But one of the closes that works best for me is after I ask for the order. There's a sales myth that says once you ask for the order, whoever speaks next loses. Now, this is a cliche which I hate for a couple of reasons. Number one, because it implies that if I get the sale, that the person I'm selling it to is a loser. And that if he doesn't buy it from me, that I'm a loser. I would like to think that we both are succeeding if I make the sale, if I'm selling the right product at the right price to the right person at the right time. Hopefully, he's going to win by buying the product, and he's going to lose if he doesn't do it. So I really hate that idea. The second thing is that it isn't necessarily true. The inexperienced salespeople very often say, you know, my marketing services, it's blah, 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 it's going to be this much, this much, this much. Can we get started today? Or whatever, they ask their closing question. Now, what they do very often, because they don't want to hear the answer, or they're afraid that the answer is going to be no, is they start talking again right away. And they never give the customer a chance to say yes or no. And that's called talking over the close, and it's a very, very bad idea. Because right away, the customer sees that you're not expecting to buy it, and he starts thinking of all those reasons, even if he's about to say yes, all the reasons why he shouldn't buy it. But if you ask your closing question, whatever it may be, would you like to start on Tuesday, would you like to start the week after that, and then you wait, and then you pause, and he's thinking it over. One of the most effective closes I have ever found is while he's thinking it over, and he's puzzling his mind, I just say, give it a shot. It is astonishing how often that kind of thing works. Just a little nudge. If it's done correctly, if it's done after he's had some time, or she has had some time to think about it, and if it's done with the complete confidence that you know that the best possible deal that you're offering this person, a great deal.
How about the walk-back close?
Walk-back close is another one of those things that salespeople are told they never do. After you make the sale, you walk out and you don't come back in because he might be having buyer's remorse. Or she might be having buyer's remorse. And you walk back in the door because you've forgotten your hat or this, that, or the other thing. And the first thing they say is, oh, you know, I've been thinking about that, and maybe we shouldn't start this now. Maybe we should think about it and then do it in a couple months or something. So salespeople, very often, are afraid to talk to the customer again after they've made the sale for a while, at least until it's solid and they've cashed the check or whatever. If they've sold the product correctly, if they've closed full disclosure, if they've bragged about the negatives and gotten everything on the table, there's absolutely no reason why they shouldn't be able to walk in immediately. One of the things that I would sometimes do when I was selling is I would get back to the car after walking into the merchant or the retailer, and I would think, you know, he bought whatever he bought, but he really should have got the next size up, the next program up. It would have worked a lot better for him. I really gave up on that. I took the easy sale, what he was willing to buy, rather than what he really needed. And then I would walk back in, because it would drive me nuts. I would walk back in right away. I'd go back in and I'd say, you know, I blew it when I was talking to you. Obviously, I didn't do a very good job of explaining that to you because, you know, you're getting this, this, and this, but what you really need is blah, blah, blah. It's astonishing how often I ended up selling them.
They appreciate it.
They appreciated that. And if I didn't, I don't think I've ever can think of a case where walking back cost me the sale.
Tell me, do you have a guarantee with your consulting service and your speaking engagements?
No. And I'll tell you why I don't. I used to work with a telemarketing company, and they would sell my consulting services when they didn't have anything else going on, and I'd pay them a percentage. And I offered a guarantee because I'm absolutely sure, particularly in this case with what I was selling, that this was going to save people and make them many, many, many times what they were spending. And all the time I was doing that, I had one guy who asked for his money back. Now, when he asked for his money back, he absolutely denigrated the product. He lied. He said, you didn't do what you promised you'd do, blah, 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 blah. I wanted you to do this, that, and the other thing. I did exactly what I promised to do.
He just wanted.
I offered to redo it and give him all these other services free. Now, we were talking about a small amount of money here. It wasn't the point. I wanted him to be a satisfied customer. Again, he threatened this, that, and the other thing, blah, blah. He was sure I wasn't going to give his money back, which I was happy to do.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted them to be happy. He basically sold himself because of that guarantee on the fact that I'd done a lousy job. And I was unscrupulous, and I was this, that, and the other thing. So he could justify getting his money back because he already had the consultation. Then he went ahead, and it was in the yellow pages so I could see it. I went ahead in the next year's directory and did exactly what I had told him to do in the consultation.
Sure, you're always going to get people like that.
I was so irritated by that I said I'm dropping the guarantee because I don't want people to sell themselves against my services. And that's why I don't do that. I don't want to give people a reason to profit by having a bad idea. It may not be something I stay with. I may change my mind on that.
Yeah, it's probably an emotional thing. I mean,
it really was.
You're always going to get people like that. No.
You're always going to get people like that. I've only gotten one in the 20 years I've been consulting, but it was enough that I said, I've never had anybody ask for that money back. You know, if somebody did, I'd probably give it to them. But I thought I was giving him a reason to be negative about my product by offering him a chance to get his money back. I'm sure he felt perfectly good about what he was doing. But then he changed his mind and did exactly what I told him to do.
Does this ring a bell? Hiding the Rotten Rhino.
Yeah, Hiding the Rotten Rhino is about bragging about the negatives. There are negatives in every situation. No matter what we do, we're never going to be able to get rid of all of them, like we've been talking about. And there's a couple of ways you can present negatives. You can present them like what I call hidden rhino sales reps. Now, what's a hidden rhino sales rep? If there's a rotting rhinoceros in the well that provides the drinking water of that country estate they're trying to sell you, they're going to do their very best to try and keep that potential negative hidden. If you mention the nasty smell, you notice they don't ever smell anything. And if you're persistent, they're going to do something to change the subject to distract you. This in sales is known as the, hey, look, there's Elvis stratagem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, hiding the rotting rhino can get the sale. There's no question about that. It's why so many inferior managers, so many inferior marketing people, so many inferior advertising people, so many inferior sales people use it and use it religiously. But hidden rhinos have an annoying way of floating back to the surface, usually sooner rather than later, and the company or the salesperson that doesn't acknowledge it is going to lose all credibility. They're going to lose the sale. So you never want to do that.
What advice would you give to these marketing consultants in ways and a couple techniques on how to control the sales calls?
Bingo. And that's exactly right. Control the sales call. Now, how do you control the sales call? You don't control the sales call by talking over the customer. You don't control the sales call by ignoring what they're saying. You control it by asking questions, okay, to start off with. First, you control it by creating an interest-creating remark, which gets his attention or her attention. Then you ask the right questions and control it that way. Then it goes back to the idea of telling and selling the whole story. I've got a presentation, okay? Now, my presentation is not going to look like the kind of speeches I've been giving during this interview. It's going to look and sound like a conversation because it has to be interactive. But I know exactly all the points I want to make in that conversation. The potential customer does not know the points I want to make. And he's not going to follow my outline for getting all that information in there. So he's going to go off on tangents. I'm going to deal with that tangent in whatever way I choose to deal with it. Either answer it or say, oh, I'm getting there. And if you ask me about price, I might say, oh, that's the best part. I'm getting to that in just a moment. But let me talk about it. And then I go right back into the point in the presentation that I'd left. Because I know these points, I have them in the order in my head that I want to cover them, and every time he takes me on a tangent, I deal with that tangent right away, either by answering it, never by ignoring it, or by dealing with it, you know, I'll get to that in just a moment, let me cover this, and something like that, and then I go right back into the point in the presentation where I left off. So by the end, by the time I've got through that, I've gotten in all the information I need to get in. Now, once in a while, you'll encounter somebody who's a real driver and will not let you go through your points. This on talking about what he wants to talk about and controlling the conversation. Now, obviously, you can't fight with a customer. You don't win if you fight with a customer or a prospect. So you deal with every point he insists upon dealing on, and then you work in your points gradually during the course of the conversation, whatever way you can. Usually, by the end of the conversation, you've either created enough interest you can get back into your presentation in the order you want to do it, or you can work in your own points just in the course of the conversation.
You've worked with small businesses and medium businesses, and certainly looking at your list of clients, you've worked with very large businesses. What would you tell a marketing consultant if he did start working with the larger businesses, what he can expect in the difference between the small mom and pop owner and the larger business with maybe more layers?
That's exactly right. It's more layers. But what you may find out when you're dealing with a larger company is except for issues of getting a decision made in a timely basis, which can take forever, or getting payments out, which can sometimes take a while, is that you might actually be dealing with a number of small companies. A lot of times when I work with a company, like I did a presentation fairly recently for Merck, and I wasn't dealing with Merck altogether, the entire Merck company, Merck Pharmaceuticals, which is probably 30, 40, 50,000 people, maybe more than that, I was dealing with the marketing people at Merck. And so that's one branch within Merck. The nice thing about that is I can also sell my services to the salespeople within Merck, to the PhDs that advise the salespeople within Merck, to all these different groups. Actually, a large company can be a community of small companies within there, all of which are opportunities for selling your services to.
How do you charge as far as your fees? You want the money up front? Do you get it after your presentation? What have you found works and doesn't work in reference to getting the money?
I have never lost a penny from a customer in 18 years. So I don't really worry about it that much, but I don't like to do billing and I don't like to wait for my money. The way it works in speaking engagements is standard. They pay you half up front to control the date, and then they pay you half at or before the presentation.
What do you do?
I do both. I mean, they pay half up front to control the date, and then the second half is due at the time of the presentation.
Before,
is the way we phrase it. Now, what happens is, sometimes people forget or they don't have the check, and I am not going to go up to the president of Merck,
right,
and say, hey, give me my money for the last half. They're good for it. I'm not worried about it. Mm-hmm. So in those cases, we'll bill them. Plus, my expenses will be billed later anyway. With a new client, that's the way we work. With an old client, I might not collect any money up front. It's just trust, because I know they're going to pay me the money, and, you know, it's not a big deal. It just depends on their situation. Sometimes they want to pay it up front because of the way they do their bookkeeping. I usually don't have a problem dealing with an old client.
And how about you sign a contract, a letter of agreement?
We sign a letter of agreement for those things. Now, usually for new consultation clients, I get all the money up front, depending on the size of the consultation. If it's a small consultation with a small business, I'll probably get all the money up front. Certainly for the Yellow Page consultations, I always get all the money up front. It's just easier. It's not that much money.
Well, you know what? We have covered a lot. This has been wonderful. Now, let me ask you this. If someone wants you for any kind of speaking engagements, consultative services, what's the best way to get in touch with you? Tell me a little bit about some of the services you provide.
Okay, well, we do all kinds of management and even marketing consultations. Speaking, keynotes, communication, management, sales are my specialties, obviously the kind of things we've talked about today. You can get in touch with me through the website, www.barrymaher.com, which is BarryMaher.com. It's also www.fillingtheglass.com. Or reach me at 760-962-9872. Talk to me or my assistant, Steve Wilson.
Barry, this has been wonderful. We were all over the place, but we covered a lot of content.
It was fun, Michael.
I really appreciate it. Thanks. Have a great day.
Okay, you
bye.
Too.
That's the end of our interview with Barry Maher. I hope you found it helpful. And for more great interviews on marketing consulting, go to Michael Senoff's MyFirstHMAClient.com.